Hi, everybody. This is Mark Ciaffardini with Go See Talk. We're about to queue up another amazing, phenomenal podcast focusing on music, composers, people in the sound industry. As I have on every one of my shows, I have my best friend, Brian Kluger of Boomstick Comics. How are you doing today, Brian?
Oh, pleasantly neato today. Almost a holiday.
Pleasantly neato. Amazing. Brian is my little Miss Sunshine. We do crazy, stupid things together. He is the spark to my creative engine. And we are so glad to be speaking to a man who you may know if you speak Russian and know the word for girl, if you like a lot of crazy movies and burlesque soundtracks, Mr. Nick Urata. Welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. Nice to meet you guys.
Nice to meet you.
Well, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot has been going on in your life. Please tell us, how have you been dealing with COVID pandemic 2020 and working so consistently?
Well, I mean, like everyone, it's been a twist. It's been a mind. I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on this or not. It's been a real mind fuck and an emotional roller coaster, but you know, I feel fortunate that myself and my family has remained healthy, and I think it has completely killed the live concert industry, which was pretty devastating. It still is. It was a big part of our lives, and pretty much everyone in my social circle, you know, this is what we've been doing, and you don't realize, who would have ever thunk that it would just come to a screeching halt. Mm. So no one was really prepared for it. So that part sucks. But luckily, in the soundtrack world, the last couple of years, we've been sort of drifting into this remote world, and the technology has gotten, has come such a long way that it makes it sort of seamless. I mean, I was thinking about like what would have happened if we had this pandemic before Zoom was online, you know, where would we be?
Sure.
it would be a dystopian nightmare. That's my two cents.
No, that's great. You know, it's funny how some composers say, well, I've already been living in this social isolation world and I'm doing, you know, virtual. So it's not different to me, but I could see how that sort of lifeblood and energy of environments, that's got to be soul sucking to just not get out there.
Yeah, that was my balance with, it's true, composing is really a lonely business and you become isolated. And that was always my balance. Just to get back in touch with what making music is all about and connecting with actual people. So it always kind of refreshed my batteries for composing. Hopefully it will come back soon.
Gotcha. Well, so where are you located now? Are you still in Colorado?
So I've split my time between LA and Colorado. I have a little studio in LA that I've been working out of for years.
Okay. Yeah. So how is that dynamic going? How's travel cuckolded you or?
It's worked out well. The two are close together. I mean, I've stopped traveling obviously since the shutdowns, but it's been pretty seamless.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's get into your creative mind. But first, we kind of want to know, where did the sort of germ to play a bouzouki and be a burlesque backup band, how did that come into your life?
Well, music was always a spark as far as I can remember. I think it was something I was born with, thankfully. I come from a musical family, so that might have helped. But I have a lot of brothers and sisters, and some of them didn't catch the spark and some of them did, but it was always a huge part of my life. And I played in marching band all through school and
got what instrument?
I started with the trumpet was my first instrument, and that's how I learned music. And then as I got into puberty in high school, I drifted into playing guitar and joining rock bands. And
was there a reason for that?
Well, I think, yeah, it's the female species. The marching band trumpet section wasn't doing it. So, but I did fall hopelessly in love with the guitar, and like I think many people, and it just became my obsession throughout high school and college. And so then I became so obsessed with that, and I kind of got the live performance bug by playing with bands, and just that feeling of collaborating with people and improvising live that on stage is pretty addicting, and opens up a lot of pathways. And so I was bouncing around in bands a lot, to answer your question about when I started to realize that everyone was kind of doing the same thing at the time. There was just this formula where you had to have two guitars and a bass and maybe a keyboard if you were really exotic. And I had just, I mean, I grew up around, you know, some around accordions, and in my early life, I got exposed to some pretty cool accordion music, and that always kind of stuck with me. And as I started to try to find my musical voice, because I didn't know who I was artistically, I just kind of started gravitating towards these exotic instruments. And when I started to put a band together, I thought, why not? I just tried to seek out people who played. I found an accordion player and a tuba player and violinist. So I just tried to put a twist on what everyone was doing with their small combos. So that was the impetus. And I found like-minded people that wanted to kind of explore, dig into all these exotic styles that we loved, and maybe kind of bring them into our fold, not necessarily be purist about it, but sort of bring it into, you know, into the pop world, I guess.
Sure.
Lack of a better word.
Well, to elaborate on that, so what sort of template did you and these acquired musicians follow? I mean, who were sort of your heroes or North Star, so to speak, in terms of teaching you what goes good together and who can play together?
Right. Well, that part was, a lot of trial and error, I guess. And I think probably one of the reasons why we're talking is that a big part of it was we were all fans of film scores, you know, so we were sort of trying to covertly, score films without a camera, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So that did inform our early direction.
Okay.
If that makes sense. But we really, we didn't have a concrete plan. I think, as I was working on being a songwriter, I started writing songs before I started writing instrumental music. And I always loved people like Tom Waits. I love, like, if you watch his evolution, he started with his acoustic guitar and then, you know, by Swordfish trombone, it was kind of like, you know, doing what we all kind of, what we aspire to, you know what I mean? Just kind of, and I think with this, I remember hearing this quote of his when I was treading water. He said to mine your own uniqueness. And I think that's great advice for any artist. You know, you just dig into what is different about yourself.
Have you seen him live or got a chance to work with him?
No, I wish. We were on the same record label, so we got to enjoy him peripherally and anecdotally, but that was Anti-Records. But we never got to work together. But, you know, the night is young.
So, I saw you in an interview and you were talking about how when you started to learn an instrument, you would kind of get bored and want to learn something that you didn't know how to play. And there's that joy and sort of a newness and not necessarily knowing the rules, but just going at it. So yeah. To more of that respect, to what you said about improvising, I guess at what point did you realize that you could successfully improvise or be on the spot on stage?
You know, it takes that took a long time. A lot of hours of basement jam sessions, but gotcha. But you know, I think a lot of practicing. I think you get to a point where you practice enough that, and it always goes horribly wrong the first, you know, 100 times you get on stage, I think, for most people. But then you have that one little, maybe a few successful bars that keep you coming back and elaborating on it. But yeah, that was also a big part of what, same with the guys in my band, guys and girls in my band, that we had all kind of studied our instruments through high school and college and got to the point where, yeah, we wanted to branch out and feel that sort of new love kind of feeling. And that can lead to a lot of joyous music.
Gotcha.
You know, definitely. And I think that was a big lesson too. I think, especially with guitar players, I noticed, you know, we get so caught up in the technical aspect of it and the that you sort of lose that ability to step out and improvise. And but when you don't really know what you're doing on something, you have no choice.
Completely understand. Yeah,
I don't know if that makes sense. You know,
yeah,
it's just good to break down any barriers you can when you're making music.
Well, we can tell that it makes you happy and you're very good at doing it, but tell us down in your core, what makes you happiest about the creative process? Is it writing the lyrics because you're claiming that you're a lyricist, or is it actually trying out instruments? What appeals to you most?
You know, I think my happiest moments is when I'm in a recording studio and when all those ideas come together and you hear it played back to you and it actually works. I think those are the moments that I kind of live for, if that makes sense.
No, I think that's great. I think that actually, we're talking to you today because we love the True Adventures of Wolf Boy and the soundtrack is phenomenal. But that second track, that 3-minute theme, is just so flavorful and full and boisterous. So I got to imagine that probably sounded great in the recording studio, didn't it?
Oh, cool. Thank you. Yeah. That's a great example of, and I think once for me and for like, you're talking about lyrics, like I'm always scribbling on pads when I get an idea or trying to record on my phone. But when you get your ideas down on tape and you can, that means you can like actually share them with people. You know what I mean? That's always a great hurdle to get over with. And yeah, that is the amazing payoff about scoring films, is you get to work with these large groups of amazing musicians. And that track you're talking about there was a lot of high fives and arm raises in the studio when we heard them playing that back. It was pretty one of those moments you live
well
for.
Deserved. It's well deserved.
Thank you.
So with going back to 2006, can you tell
like your
us?
There, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Do you know where this is?
It looks familiar. Is that Fox?
No, Abbey Road.
Abbey Road. Ah, wow.
they're playing music for you. I want to go back to 2006. Will you tell me the crazy fun story on how you came about with Little Miss Sunshine? Because it's such a fascinating, wonderful story that may have sparked the notion to have you on at a radio station. Is that true with the directors?
Oh, yeah. So it was one of those rare moments of chance that happens once or twice in a lifetime. We had released our third album independently It was called How It Ends, and we had gotten a little love from a lot of the independent NPR kind of stations. Like, I don't know, where are you guys located?
Dallas, Texas.
Oh, okay. So I'm sure you have one of these, hopefully, in your town. In LA, there's one called KCRW.
Yeah, we have them.
Yeah. They're kind of a flagship for indie radio, and they're really amazing at fearless, just playing anything they like. And that's the beauty of, you know, non-commercial radio. Anyway, long story short, they were one of the few radio stations that were playing our self-released album. And the directors, John and Val, lived in Palisades in LA and were listening on Saturday to Morning Becomes Eclectic, I think they call it. And they heard our track, and they had been looking for maybe a band to score their first indie film. And they were struck by the sound of our track, and they sought us out, and they, unbeknownst to us, came and saw us when we played a couple of really small club shows. And one day they called me up, and we started working together. And, you know, indie films have their trials and tribulations. They had it from their side of the production, and it was our first trial by fire for a score. But somehow it all came together, and luckily the film resonated with a huge swath of people.
Well, and the music did too. Like, I own the soundtrack on vinyl here. It's like, I think the music makes the film. Like, I mean, all the other elements do too, but the music is so great. And that really, can you talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, that's a testament to kind of why, I think, because it was such an unorthodox way of doing it. You know, since then I've done tons of films, and it never comes together really that organically. And the fact that we had never scored a film, I think, was a huge part of it. You know, we didn't really know what we were doing. And
you were pushed into the deep end.
Yeah, we were thrown into the deep end. And plus the material was so moving, which really helps. And the directors were so loving and encouraging. I think it was just a perfect storm of luck, you know.
I was going to say in your collaboration, the collaborating process usually happens towards the end of the filming, right? Or towards the end of everything in a movie.
Yeah.
Was Little Miss Sunshine any different, or is it kind of different in each project?
In a way, it was almost one of the harshest experiences of that, because film companies cut it dangerously close to score their films usually, you know. It's the last icing on the cake usually. This one cut it really close. So we did not have much time at all. And I think that also can be a good thing. You know, I've been living my whole life on deadlines. I don't think I'd ever get anything finished if I didn't have a deadline.
Right on.
Well, parlaying that, you worked with Michael Dana on that, and now when you worked with Valerie and Jonathan again on Ruby Sparks, you're under your own label, kicked the band to the curb, kicked Michael to the curb. Was it daunting doing it by yourself, or how did you take that next step?
Well, I certainly didn't kick any of those people to the curb.
I'm being facetious.
Yeah. But it is it was daunting, especially with John and Val, because they're super, super into the music, which is a great thing, because a lot of directors, they're just like, I don't know, can you make it better? That's the only note they'll give you. But they're really musical people. They came from, you know, the rock music video world. which makes it super cool. But you know, we had a lot more time on that one, which was nice. And we sat in a little spread of offices in West LA and worked on that for like 6 months. And I was really, really happy with the result of that one.
I think you should be. I want to hold this up. This is the promo copy that I got from the press tour. Jonathan and Valerie came to Dallas, and I spoke to them, and I spoke to Paul and Zoe. And Brian, were you in that press circuit?
I did, I definitely asked about the music too. Okay. I remember. Yeah.
So it was a tremendous effort all around. So this, I listened to this for probably 2 years. So it was a staple in my car. So thank you.
Thank you. That makes me
providing
feel
a soundtrack to my life.
So you guys actually have listened to me.
Oh no! Yes, we have.
Yes. I do a lot of these, you know, and then people and some guys are like, "And who are you? And what do you do?"
What is it you do here?
Exactly. So that's refreshing. Anyway,
did I read correctly somewhere that you got to do the music for a live performance of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory?
Yeah. It was the original Willy Wonka. Yeah, it was. We did it with this production group here in LA. And we got to do it at the Hollywood Bowl, and
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was
because that music's iconic, and you get to put your own spin on that. What was that like?
Yeah, we had this great arrangement team that really kind of immersed themselves in our band Devotchka's albums, and they carefully arranged each of the numbers with the band and the orchestra in mind. So it was a really cool, the actual performance was really cool. I mean, it was a lot of work, and there was a lot of, it was fraught with danger. we had one of the things they like to do, this particular production company, they do this with a lot of different films at the Hollywood Bowl. They like to invite guest singers. So we would turn off the film, and we'd have these, but they're mostly like actors that aren't, they all could sing. They all did a great job, but they're not like, you know, trained singers. So it was a little, up until the performance night, we were like, cause we didn't get time. I don't know. Am I boring you with this?
No, I like this.
It was just really exciting. We didn't get to perform with the singers until like the day before the show, and it was at the Hollywood Bowl, which is like no pressure there, right? But it all came together beautifully, and you know, that film is just so ingrained in all of our psyche, and to have it 50 feet high behind you with a live orchestra, it was an amazing experience. I hope we get to reprise the show, because
no, I would like that. And is there a way to purchase like the music you did for that show at the Hollywood Bowl?
Yeah, you know, I don't think there is. There's some, some of it's on YouTube, but
okay,
I don't think there's so many like copyright
things about it.
Copyright tightropes to walk on that line.
Right,
and you know, that is one of the most famous movies in the world, and probably one of Warner Brothers' biggest movies of all time. So they're really protective of it, and they were gracious enough to let us do it. But I imagine that was probably the main reason why you couldn't
do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Put the soundtrack out.
So where does your mind journey to when you're in front of an audience? Is there a place where your mind goes when you're in front, you're about to like play that first chord or conduct that first note? Where's your mind go? A state of euphoria.
you know, I'm not going to lie. Before the first note, I'm usually scared shitless, no matter what the size of the crowd, even if I'm playing for friends in the living room. I don't know, I've always had just a bit of stage fright, and I need to get into the music in order to, I think the main thing with that question is I try to get as far away from my mind as possible and myself, if that makes sense.
All right. Well, I like it.
You got to be the ball. Be the ball.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of that.
So
I've had a few times where I was like, oh, man, I'm totally killing it right now. And then my amp will fall off or something.
So I'm curious about one title on your resume is the cobbler that you worked with John Debney. Now John is a good friend of the site, and we've talked to him a bunch of times. But what was that dynamic like, and how did you two split this?
Yeah, I don't remember why we both got put on that project, but it was that was my favorite part about the project, other than Adam Sandler is awesome, and the film was really fun, but. But yeah, working with John was like a masterclass in composing, and he's just such a great guy.
Yeah.
So it was really, really fun. And we got to use Devotchka as the backing band again, which was really fun. It was just all around. It was just another stroke of luck that they wanted both of us for some reason. I think they wanted the balance, or they're hoping to, by putting us together, they would get something totally unique. And I think they did. Yeah.
Now, one of the things that is maybe, I don't know if it's frustrating is the right word to use, but when you're writing music for a film or a TV show, you're kind of, like you said, you're coming into the end and you're either adding something that's not there and you have limitations. But when you're on stage or you're writing your own music in a band, you kind of have a limitless canvas. So what do you like better? And the reason I ask that is because sometimes when you do music to a score, you're like, well, it's you, but it's not you that it could be. So I guess what do you enjoy most?
Yeah. Well, I think there's appeals to both sides of that. I think one of the reasons why I got so into, or one of the things I loved about first getting to score a film was that the very thing you just talked about is like when you're sitting there with a blank page, that can be very daunting. You know what I mean? Like but with a film, you actually have a direction and you have something to go for and something to go off of. Does that make sense?
No,
you're not just left alone with your own terrible thoughts.
Well, yeah.
That was the appealing thing. And then when you're right, then you're like, you're sort of, slaving over this film that it's you don't always get great films to score, but you bond with them, but you're right, then it makes you appreciate that much more not having those confines and guardrails to just go, and that makes you open up to what thoughts are bouncing around in your own head. Does that make sense? So there's a balance, and they both, I think, they both help to affirm each other.
Oh, I get that. I think that makes a lot of sense. And, taking that creative step then to the next step, do you ever get in a situation where, you have that lyricist DNA in you and you're scoring something? Do you ever just go to whomever the director is, I think we need a song here. I think we need a song here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm a big advocate of that.
Okay.
Songs and silence, I think, is another thing. But yeah, that's another tough thing is sometimes, the production can't afford the song. You know what I mean? That's usually the main hurdle. Otherwise, mm-hmm. I think you would hear a lot more songs in films. But
I guess I'm sorry. What I'm getting at is like you do the song. Bring on Devotchka. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
they couldn't afford that.
Yeah, no, I have had to do that before.
Okay.
But I think a huge part of that is what I've noticed is that you'll be hearing a score and it fits nicely with the film and the dialogue, and then when they open it up to a song, I think it's the humanity of a human voice really that kind of sucks you into that moment, so that it is very important, I think, to have couple good songs in every score.
Gotcha. Well, let's just jump into the Adventures of Wolf Boy real quick. Unless Brian, looks like you might have a...
No. Wolf Boy is good.
Okay. It seems like after doing this for so long, the stars really aligned. You sort of had this carnivalesque movie and it gels perfectly with your sensibilities and the things that you like to do. You know, let's start ground zero. Martin Krejci, what were some of the conversations you had developing your palette?
Oh man, I love Martin, and we've since become great friends. And yeah, I don't know if you realize this, for some reason, probably another one of the challenges of indie film. We started working on this over two years ago now. And so it was a long journey. And I started off by reading the script, and like you said, it was just like, bing, it's like, could there be a more perfect movie for me to score right now? And luckily Martin was, he also comes from a music video background and, you know, is a very musical person and had a lot of ideas and direction for the score, so that worked out really good. And one of the things we did is he when we first met, he came to my place in LA, and I played him a couple of things that he asked me to write some stuff just off of, like, my first impression of the script and what I thought was visualizing. So I wrote him a bunch of stuff, and he came over and you know, sometimes the first playback of any composer will identify with me here. It's like, when you first play your music back to a new director that you're working with, it's 50-50. if you're gonna work together for a long time, or if he's gonna run screaming and you're gonna get a phone call the next day that you're fired.
Oh no.
that was the thought in my back of my head, but it couldn't have. Luckily, we totally hit it off as people and musically, and so he actually took these pieces that I'd written and was sure to, he was playing them for the actors as they were shooting the scenes, and so I think that kind of helped kind of build this authentic score from the start. So we used some of those themes later on and built on them and came up with The True Adventures of Wolf Boy.
Yeah, and that's what Brian and I saw this movie last year at Fantastic Fest, and I had an interview with Martin, and it went very well, and the stars did align. I think that there's just something that works with the, you know, it's a story at a time that, you know, you don't see these movies at this day and age. It seems like an 80s movie that got, you know, left on a shelf for 30 years and someone just found it. So it's really, really amazing effort.
Mark and I go down and we usually get like a crazy house with like, you know, 10, 12 people. And we all went to see Wolf Boy. We all loved it. Like, we were talking about it. And in like in our top 10 or top 5 movies of the festival, Wolf Boy was definitely in there.
Oh, cool. That's great. So, I kind of remember that, but that was what, it was pretty much fresh off the dub stage, I think, when you guys saw it. So that's encouraging that you like.
Going back to, oh wow, you have that short amount of time. The film company or the director is like, okay, you've got 2 weeks to score this movie.
Yeah,
and then we send it.
Yeah, exactly. This one wasn't like that. We actually got to take our time, but we did have to go back in and rescore a bunch of stuff. But yeah, I'm glad you guys like the finished product.
For sure. And so going with, you know, making music, do you prefer analog to digital or a mix of both?
You know, I love analog, but I've, like most people, I can't live without digital now. I'm sort of hooked. And with the budgets and you know, we were just talking about this, the crazy scheduling of producing these scores, digital is really kind of necessary. And it's pretty magical, to tell you the truth. Yeah. There's some magic dust in there.
I like it.
So I think a mix of both, and I think most musicians are hip to that these days, that if you can find a balance between analog on the front end and digital on the back, I think you're in a good place, kind of staying true.
Cool.
But I mean, nothing sounds as good as that stuff that was recorded, you know, in the middle of the 20th century, you know.
Right.
It's not going to sound that good, and it's kind of depressing.
If you could have some magic dust you could pull out of a drawer somewhere, and you could name an instrument the Jurata, what type of instrument would you like it to be?
Oh man, well, the last, you know, I don't know, God, it's been 20 years now, but I'm really obsessed with the theremin. It's kind of like my passion and my therapy. And I think the appeal of it was, you know, with trumpet, you're like squeezing your face together and it hurts physically. And then with guitar, you're looking at frets. And then I found this theremin and you're free and you're just playing the air and you're, you know, using space and time. And so if I could somehow harness that with, I don't know, with the, I don't know, I guess that is kind of my dream instrument. If I could speak through it somehow, if I could have a combination of a speaking voice with a theremin. I mean, it does closely resemble a human voice. You just can't get any words out of it.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but somehow bridge those two gaps together.
Well, the alternate of that is a Thermion, the creature from Galaxy Quest, who doesn't sound as nice as a theremin. La, 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 la.
That's great. So you've played a bunch of places over your career, but what's the strangest location or venue you've ever played music live?
Man, we've had a lot of those. I'd have to say, you know, it comes to mind, I never thought I would play on a cruise ship, but we we actually played it on a cruise ship. And
amazing.
Yeah. And it was cool. It was like it was kind of one of those like rock and roll kind of cruise ships. I mean, it wasn't rock and roll necessarily. It was.
Was it like, did you have like a stay like for a month, or was it like just a week long cruise?
It was like a weekend cruise, and it was with the Specials were there. Specials was my favorite. The English Beat were there, which they were heroes of mine from my childhood. Was it the Dropkick Murphys?
Oh my.
Yeah. Sure. Nice.
that went off. Like, so after playing that, would you ever play a cruise again?
I don't know. It was kind of like one of the band members who put the cruise on was kind of a fan of ours and invited us to do it. And it seemed like an offer we couldn't refuse. And it was only 3 days. We were like, what's the harm? And there weren't many bands like us on there. So we weren't sure how we were going to go over. And the weird thing is like, it's like imagine playing a concert and then being stuck with the audience for the next 2 days in a small area. But funny. it actually turned out to be a good thing. Because you know, you end up making friends and having drinks with all these people.
That's
and
cool.
And seeing a lot of music you wouldn't have ever seen. And I think a lot of the one thing I got was a lot of people were appreciative that they'd never seen a band like ours before, which was cool. The weird part about it was that I was getting gonna get to is where they have these like a real theater. It's really nice. It's like, you know, one of the nicer theaters we've ever seen in the, I guess it's in the front or back of the boat. And I mean, the stage is going like this the whole time. And it was a mind fuck for sure. And I was, you know, I'm not gonna lie, I was like seasick the whole time trying to hold it together and trying to remember the lyrics while not trying not to puke, you know. And the other thing about those ships is just like there's booze everywhere. The booze flows like water. So that with the seasickness, it was definitely a strange experience.
That's great. Also, what is the most thrilling music experience, both as a musician and as a fan, for you?
As a fan, you mean like a show I've seen?
Yeah, like a live show you went to, your front row, something like that.
Yeah, I have a lot of those. I love blabbing about those. I think a couple of ones that come to mind. I got to see Jane's Addiction when they came out with their first album, and people obviously heard about them because the place was packed. But I was young, and I'd heard their album, and I was like, God, something about this band is really speaking to me. And it was one of the most amazing live shows I've ever seen, just for the spectacle of it. And, I mean, they probably only played like 5 songs, but see if people, it was like, one of those first concert experiences when you're young that you never forget. Yeah. I'd never That's been awesome. In a crowd that was just moving me, kind of like the cruise ship. You couldn't do anything about it. You were just... the place was so packed. The music was so loud, and Perry Farrell was such a he was so combative with the crowd. I never saw anybody, and like he was getting pelted in the face with full beers, still singing these notes that how was he doing that, and just taunting the crowd and getting in under everybody's skin. But like I'd never seen anybody pull that off before. Before or since.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, that definitely shaped my musical life for sure. Do you got time for a couple more?
Yeah, hell yeah.
Another time I got invited to this, when I was kicking around in Boulder, we used to play this cool place called the Fox Theater all the time, and they hosted this kind of a really, it was kind of like a radio conference, and because I like, I had worked, plugged in chords and played opening sets a lot at the show, I was able to get a sneak in with they'd have like really big name people come and play, and it's like a 700 seater, and I happened to get in the night that John Fogerty was there, and I don't know if you knew this, like he was under, for years, he had some sort of crazy lawsuit where he couldn't play his own songs.
Own songs. I was just about to say that, the man who couldn't play his own songs from a lawsuit.
And this was like, I think the first night that he had gotten out from under that. And he had his original amp and some of his original bros from back in the Creedence days. And I mean, what a songwriter, and to see him play with such joy, play those songs that he hadn't been able to play in 20 years or whatever, and songs that have shaped all of the whole freaking American, experience. It was epic.
That is amazing.
That was earth shattering, yeah. And man, what a voice. He's still got it.
No, for people, friends.
He looked like a 20-year-old up there.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That voice is something special, and there's never been replicated either. Yeah. Is there any particular, since you're such a huge fan of film scores as we are as well, is there any particular music moment in a movie that has always stuck with you since you were little that you always like get inspired by? You wake up and you think like, oh man, this music moment in this scene just really does it for me.
Oh man, that's a good one. Man, you're putting me on the spot.
It's all good. A lot of people absolutely mention E.T., of course, the last, 10 minutes, but yeah, it's an easy one.
Sure. Yeah. Man, I just remember that scene. I think Lawrence of Arabia was like the first score that like knocked me on my ass when I was like, I was really little. And I just remember that horrible scene where his little buddy gets sucked into the sand, and it's like moon, it's got this beautiful blue moonlit atmosphere, and then it goes right into that theme, that Maurice Jarre, is that his name, or is that how you pronounce his name? But yeah, I think that's one that really still brings tears to my eyes when I hear that.
Good deal.
And we'll talk about taking a theme and milking it for every last. I mean, that one still stands the test of time.
Well, I mean, that scene would not be as good as it was today without the music.
Yeah.
I mean, because we've all seen those YouTube videos when, like, people take the music out of, like, Star Wars, and you're just like, the sound effects is like, what's happening here? This is awkward. But the music makes it.
Yeah. I know. Could you imagine Star Wars? I mean, that's one of our favorite scores of all time, for sure. And, yeah. What if it had been, like, scored, like, you know, with synthesizers or something?
Synthesizers. Yeah. John Carpenter scores Star Wars. And being in the business for so long and a fan of music, what's the most curious recording you own, whether it be like, you know, a cover of something that nobody's heard of, a outtake from one of your sessions, or something that was recorded, you know, in the 15th century? What is the most curious recording you own?
That's a good one. I'm going to have to think about that one for a minute. I'm sorry.
All good. Oh, no, all good. Yeah. Well, one of mine, I have a band, Shonen Knife, Japanese all-girl band, punk.
Yeah, I remember them.
Yeah, they sing about food, and they did a cover of Weird Al's Eat It.
Oh, wow.
And it's unbelievably good.
that's a really good one. I'm sorry. I don't have a good answer for that.
All good. We'll get back to you. Yeah, we'll think about that.
Well, let me ask you a question. So let's go back to just really quickly, the True Adventures of Wolf Boy. There is John Turturro's ringmaster character. It's a very larger than life story. So there's a lot of tangible things that you can graft your music onto. So are there things in other movies that maybe are subtextual or like a crazy idea that you latched onto this one key scene of a character walking through a door, and like that was the impetus for the score?
Yeah, I try to find those moments in every film when you're just starting to dig into it. I think one that brings to mind is I had to come up with a sort of villainous theme for Nicole Kidman. And so you guys are music geeks. You've probably seen one of these before.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
But I had just discovered it as a gift. And like I was saying, I had to come up with this villainous sound for Nicole Kidman's character in Paddington. And it was gonna have to be like recurring, so I had to make it interesting. And I dug this thing out and recorded a bunch of it. And the director just loved it. We milked it for everything it was worth through that score. And it does help to have kind of a recurring theme especially for a villain, because you know something is about to go down.
A lot like that shark in that 1975 movie.
Yeah.
Mouth, chin.
Exactly. So that was my version of the.
Excellent.
Successful experience I have with that, and a lot of.
Yeah, I remember the marxophone. I talked to Nathan Johnson about. He used a lot of it in The Young Ones, which is a movie that came out quite a few years ago, or 5 years ago. It's a really good sound. Was there a learning curve for that? You know, did you trial and error it?
Oh, for the marxophone?
Yeah.
No, it's pretty easy to play. Just press the button. It's all about just getting it to fit into your piece is the biggest part. Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, Nick, let's just tell the listeners what you got lined up, because I know your track record is great. What, you know, what can we be wowed by in the next couple of years if you allowed to speak about projects?
Man, well, I'm working on a new album with Devotchka, which I'm very excited about. Like we were saying, you know, just starting with nothing and bringing songs, wrestling songs out of the ether is it takes a long time, especially for me, but that's something I hope to bring to the world in the next year or two. And let's see what else. I had a film released recently called 17 Blocks. Have you guys heard about that one at all?
It's a documentary.
Yeah. But I wanted to maybe plug that one. It was made by a friend of mine named Davey Rothbard, who's kind of this amazing storyteller. He's been on This American Life. He's just a journalist, storyteller, artist, and he, when he was living in DC, he met this striking little boy named Emmanuel, who was 9 years old. And he was sort of living in the projects of DC at the time, and he gave him a video camera, and he stayed in close contact and asked him to just kind of film his life, and stayed in close contact with the family, and ended up with like 20 years of footage about this one family in DC and their struggle with race and poverty. And so it's kind of like almost like a boyhood sort of documentary that and it just came out really, it's really special. And I think it's out this year. I'm not sure if it's on demand yet, but definitely if you guys can check it out, it's called 17 Blocks. And the title comes from the projects that these guys grew up in is literally 17 blocks from our nation's capital.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we'll be happy to plug that. Do you know when the soundtrack would be released? Do you have any info on that?
You know what? I don't know if we're going to be able to release a formal soundtrack, but it might be something I might be able to put it out myself on SoundCloud or something like that. So,
okay. Could you do a live virtual performance for your fans?
Of that film?
No, of the soundtrack, just, you know, like a symphonic experience or something like that.
Yeah. We have attempted that a few times. Like I was saying, we talked about with Willy Wonka and my band, Devotchka, we've been doing this. We've done it a few times now. Someone asked us to do this, but we picked the film, The Man with the Movie Camera. Are you guys familiar with that classic silent
film? I think I know of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those films that if you dig deep enough, it comes up on everybody's like top 10 greatest films of all time. And we wrote a score to this silent film. It's pretty amazing. How could I describe it? It's kind of like Kayana Stasi from am I saying that right?
Koyaanisqatsi? Scotzi?
Yeah, you know that documentary?
From Philip Glass? Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like, the score isn't like that, but the film is like that. It was shot by a Ukrainian director in like 1928.
All right.
It's like a day in the life is it Belarus, I think? Or no, it's a day in the life. I think it's shot in Kiev.
Okay.
Like 1928. It's a beautiful film. And we wrote a score to it, and we've got to play it live like 3 or 4 times now. And it's a really cool experience because it's sort of improv, and it's sort of fraught with, you know, with timing mistakes. So each performance is totally unique.
Well, great. Nick, before our time is up, I have to know who or what is the man from San Sebastian? What's the story behind that? Where did he come from?
Well, actually, I guess it came from a while back. We were lucky enough to get asked by the nation of Spain has this sort of great artistic, what would you call it, artistic outreach program where the arts are very big and the government supports it, and they they will bring acts from all over the world and send them around to little villages, and every little, these amazing little villages all over the south of Spain and the Basque region, I guess it's called. You know, all these little villages have little theaters in it, and we got to do this tour of southern Spain, and it was just mind-bogglingly beautiful. And we'd go to these little villages, and everyone would come out and to the little theater and watch us play. And but I did start seeing I started seeing some of the graffiti from the separatists, you know. It's like this fairy tale sort of atmosphere, but then you start seeing like this because you know the Basque region wants to kind of separate from Spain. It's been a long-standing, I guess, sort of thing the way I understand it. And there's been some, and there was an attempted in the city of San Sebastian. We went there and I saw all this separatist graffiti and learned that some shit had gone down there. I don't know. Am I making sense? Anyway, it's kind of like a revolution can pop up from anywhere. And the man from San Sebastian was trying to convince his friends that we'd be better off if we separate from the motherland.
Well, I'd like to convince my friends that they would be a lot better if they listened to the man from San Sebastian. It's a great song. It's very catchy. Yeah.
Well, I probably just ruined it for everybody with that long one.
Well, Nick, you are simply the best. Thank you so much for your time. We hope to talk to you again soon.
Man, it's been great talking to you guys. I hope I didn't babble on too much.
Keep up the work.
You're doing good things.
Thank you.
And I look forward to more podcasts.
Yes. Excellent.
All the best, Nick.
Hopefully we'll see you in Dallas in person one day.
Oh man, that's drinks on us.
Yeah. Two rounds.